You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. On March 21st, 2013, Beth Parnitza presented the third lecture in our six-part CPN Thursday series entitled The Civil War Through Different Lenses. How does an action like the looting of Fredericksburg reflect on the culture of the Army of the Potomac and of the country at large? How do we think about the looting in the great scheme of battle? How is it that the looting of Fredericksburg can be considered a form of victory? These and many more questions are answered in this interesting podcast. Beth Parnitza is an historian with the National Park Service at the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park, where she supervises the Chancellorville Battlefield Center and manages volunteers and social media. A 2011 graduate of West Virginia University, her research interests focus mainly on the human element of the Civil War, particularly in understanding the steps taken by individuals toward a harder kind of war and their motivations to do so. The lecture series was organized by award-winning historian and Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer Rick Britton in conjunction with the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. Our podcast is entitled Such is War, The Looting of Fredericksburg. Here's Beth Parnitza.
First I'd like to say thank you to everyone. My name, if anyone was wondering, is pronounced Parnitza, so we were very close. And I do appreciate the opportunity to come back here a third time. I also appreciate everybody's patience. I know it's never a good idea to be late for your own talk, but despite this being my third trip here, I actually got lost. I did not get lost the first two times. I don't know what that says about me, but I do apologize. So when Rick asked me to speak here, I got very excited because the last two times I came to speak, I spoke about other battles, which, of course, working at a battlefield park is one of my passions. But the other, and we always ended up talking about this at the end of the night, was my research about the looting of Fredericksburg. So when he said he was having a series about looking at the war through different lenses, this is certainly one of those great lenses that we can look at it through. And so tonight we'll be talking about hard war and a little bit of cultural history. And now, cultural history is one of those fuzzy terms that academic types use, so I'm sorry to throw that at you tonight. What it means is we'll be getting a little more into the mindsets and into the heads of the soldiers who were fighting here. So we're not going to go into too much detail about just what they did and where. We'll talk about what they did and where, but more on the broad scheme and more in terms of looking at why they did what they did and what would have motivated these soldiers to wholesale loot a town. We'll also take a look at some misconceptions about what actually took place in the streets of Fredericksburg. So I have a lot of questions scattered throughout here. You guys can feel free to answer them or just treat them rhetorically, whichever works best for you. But I'm going to start out with several that I want you all to think about as we go throughout. So I want us to think about how we view controversial actions like looting. How does an action like the looting of Fredericksburg reflect on the culture of the Army of the Potomac and the country at large? And also, how do we think about the looting in the great scheme of battle? We tend to think of victories as taking place on the battlefield, maybe a little bit in the political realm. There are political victories, too. How is it that the looting can also be a victory? And is it a victory? Should we treat it as such? And also, what did it mean during the war, and what does it mean to us now? What are the long-term implications of something like the looting of Fredericksburg? And then finally, just what did happen so that we can start to understand all of these bigger, broader questions. So Ambrose Burnside, the new commander of the Army of the Potomac, marches his army quickly to Fredericksburg in late fall, early winter of 1862. As his army converges on Fredericksburg, however, he has quite a problem because no one told him that the pontoon bridges that he ordered were not going to make it in time. So he instead ends up staring down Robert E. Lee across the river from Fredericksburg for quite some time, long over 2 weeks. Eventually, when the pontoon bridges arrive, he bombards the town in frustration because Confederate soldiers are opposing his crossing and he doesn't know what else to do. He eventually sends men rowing across the river in pontoon boats to fight street by street to gain the town. losing many men along the way. The looting of the town will take place immediately after the Union Army gains the town, from the evening of December 11th all the way up through and during the Battle of Fredericksburg on December 13th. A lot of people think it's confined to just December 11th or just December 12th, but it happens for almost the entire time that Union soldiers are occupying the town. Which does beg the question, what happens when you set an army loose on a largely unoccupied enemy town? Most of the inhabitants had fled the town weeks before. Some had returned in those ensuing weeks when no battle occurred, but for the most part, Fredericksburg is an unoccupied city. So I have one great quotation that really helps to sum things up in a bit of a comical way. The writer recollects seeing one gigantic private of the Irish Brigade wearing the white satin bonnet of some fair secesh bride, while another sported a huge scoop bonnet of the olden time, a coffee pot that would hold 10 gallons. Another was staggering under a monstrous feather bed for two. While the Inspector General of the Corps, this is the Second Corps, entering a noble house in the outskirts, found it occupied by the picket reserve, every man of whom had added to his uniform a lady's chemise, taken from the well-stored presses of this abode of luxury. So these men have just gone to town at Fredericksburg's expense. But this can be a pretty touchy subject. Here it's more of a comical one. But there's a lengthy correspondence in our park's collections records about a McGuffey reader that was picked up in the streets of Fredericksburg. Picked up. What does that mean? Well, it certainly doesn't mean, if you ask this descendant, doesn't mean that it was looted, it doesn't mean that it was stolen, and you had better not say it, because it was picked up in the streets by her ancestor. So descendants don't want to think of their ancestors as thieves. And how many of us, well, there could be a fairly even divide, we are in Virginia, how many of us want to think of the Army of the Potomac as simply this vandal horde? If you ask any of the occupants of Fredericksburg, they do. They are number one to posit that that is who they are. But say that you're descended from someone who served in the Army of the Potomac. Do you want to think that that's what your army was doing, what your ancestor was doing? Just running rampant in the streets in ladies' clothing and stealing whatever you'd like? I'd like, actually, for all of you to raise your hands if you know someone or if you yourself own spoils of war. I do. All right. So maybe this isn't isolated to the Army of the Potomac. I know I happen to own a pair of chopsticks because my grandfather served in World War II and picked them up from a dead Japanese soldier. Is that exactly how I want to think of my grandfather? Maybe not. Maybe, at times. But it's the reality. And I think it's about time we started to get to the heart of just why these sort of things take place. But Fredericksburg will be the first town to be ransacked since the British burned Washington in the War of 1812. And it's done by Americans this time. Again, this is different because this is an American army looting a town that 3 years before was unquestionably American soil. So it looks an awful lot like home. This isn't necessarily an invading army, or it wouldn't have been 3 years ago. But that's the nature of a civil war. Again, it raises some big questions, not only because looting is a timeless act, but also because an army itself has the role of discipline, right? What happens when you lose control of that army? And then again, just what did happen, which is what we're about to explore. Because we have misperceptions of the looting of Fredericksburg that range from a wholesale burning of the town to raping and pillaging like the Dark Ages. I promise that did not happen. But then also, was this justified? Several of our soldiers will go to great lengths to justify their actions. We're going to look at that just as we go along. And then in the end, who is ultimately responsible for what took place in the streets of Fredericksburg? And then finally, looking back 150 years later, how should we study and how should we consider this action, considering again that several of you raised your hands, that you have spoils of war yourself? So for the most part, the looting began as a search for food or a search for provisions. We have great examples of people taking tobacco, taking butter, especially mattresses were well-liked in the streets, as you can imagine, for pretty obvious reasons. I have several examples here from the 106th Pennsylvania. Two or three men I saw with their haversacks full of Confederate notes that were afterwards used to buy many a chicken, pie, or loaf of bread during our subsequent marches through Virginia. Private dwellings were entered, and at first, groups would be seen examining the furniture, books, pictures, etc. Others amusing themselves, playing the piano, to be followed by others to carry off such things as struck their fancy, only to be dropped at the next house for something else, and finally, to destroy what they could not take away.
Right, so here you see a few examples of
things that were taken in Fredericksburg. We have a teacup picked up in Fredericksburg, with an accompanying letter. These are currently held in the park's collection. This teacup was also filled with butter, as the soldier describes in his letter. He was trying to find a way to take it with him, so he decided to take a teacup as well. Teacups were popular. A Union soldier picked up the two cups in the upper right-hand corner. But some of the destruction in Fredericksburg was also just that, just destruction. We have at the bottom here a bread tray that was burned when Union soldiers left it on a stove in Fredericksburg. So they might have been cooking themselves something. It's hard to say, but they carelessly left it on the stove, and its inhabitants came back to find it fairly destroyed, as well as probably much of their house was also wrecked in the process. But here, another account from the 35th Massachusetts. The visitors to the main streets returned, generally bringing some useless article which the inhabitants had not removed, and which had attracted the soldier's fancy, but which he was not allowed to retain by the provost guard. Tobacco was discovered in great abundance, in various shapes of pig, plug, and twist. Several had found old-fashioned calico dresses and bonnets, and came back dressed in them, cutting a swell appearance and exciting much mirth. It was a sickening mixture of death and frivolity. So that paints us a bit of a different picture, a mixture of death and frivolity. Here, men stand on the brink of a major battle. On the edge of life and death, they're really walking that line. And they just go on holiday in the streets of Fredericksburg, taking and breaking other people's things. Some people say that they were simply ridding themselves of anxiety by doing this. Some, they were just having fun, realizing this might be their last night or day on earth. Because if you've had to fight to get across the river, I think we all inevitably know what's about to come next. If this is your last night on earth, how would you like to spend it? It's possible that many of you would say, well, not wearing other people's clothes, Beth. But again, some people limited themselves to souvenirs, small souvenirs, or to simply gathering provisions. There's great accounts from the Irish Brigade diving in the Rappahannock River to fish up tobacco. They just wanted tobacco. Tobacco had been sunk, by the way, by the Confederates, who didn't want it to fall into other people's hands. But in other cases, a more carnival atmosphere developed. And so here we have, again, another instance of someone taking a souvenir, this time Henry Abbott, who's a blue-blooded Massachusetts man, who's again taking on a little bit more of an air of memento or souvenir searching here. He said, I tried to get you some memento of Fredericksburg, but got nothing better than a commonplace edition of Byron. I've got a very good edition of Plutarch's Lives for the governor. I did get a most beautiful writing desk, but it was taken away from my servant. I have two children's books for Frank and Arthur. I went into nearly every house to get some nice little silver thing for Mama and Mary Welch, but it was too late. Macy got just the thing, a little bed lamp of silver. His servant? The desk got taken away by his servant? These aren't necessarily soldiers who are hurting for possessions. As I said before, Henry Abbott is a member of the 20th Massachusetts, the Harvard Regiment. This is a wealthy man. He doesn't need a little bed lamp of silver. He's doing this not for wealth, and that's a common thing among many of these soldiers. They're not doing this because they need these possessions or because they need the money. They're doing it because they're looking for a souvenir, looking for a way to remember Fredericksburg. But again, a more carnival scene begins to develop among many of these men. I'll change the slide again. So here we have a sketch right in the heart of downtown Fredericksburg. Since I heard you all maybe going to Fredericksburg soon, if you're, or it's close by if you're ever there, this is right along Caroline Street. So right in the heart of town, you see sacking going on, men sitting in the center in rocking chairs, digging through trunks, certainly at their ease. But here's an account from, again, the first Minnesota writer, who is right along Caroline Street, who said it was a rich scene. There was a dirty soldier dressed in the choicest silks, escorted by other soldiers dressed in long tailcoats and plug hats. Some were loaded down with tobacco, whiskey, wines, silver and chinaware, and the finest kind of bed clothing. One of the boys picked up a violin, and a soldier was soon found who could play it, and so they took positions for a cotillion. Between sets, the ladies would sit on the curbstones, and the gentlemen would do the honors. But I cannot do justice to the scene. Wait a minute. Men are wearing dresses again, and this time they're dancing in the streets? So another account, again from some Massachusetts men, who says that there were officers in the regiment masquerading as a Mrs. Smith and a Miss Jones when a shell broke through the house they were occupying. Never did anyone get outside of nightcap and nightgown quicker than did these officers, who were willing to be shot as men, but not as women. So, right, so I'm going to pause for just a moment to talk about what it means to be a man wearing a dress in the 19th century. Because here we have a comic Valentine, and so there was this wonderful practice in the 19th century of sending insulting Valentines to people on Valentine's Day. I revived the practice among my friends, and they weren't so thrilled with it. But if you wanted to tell a suitor exactly what you thought of him, this was your great opportunity. Thank goodness it's Valentine's Day, because you can send him, if he's serving in the Home Guard, this delightful comic, which says, "You enlist not to fight at your dear country's call. You keep from the fold where the brave fight and fall. A sneak and a coward, and no force or persuasion could make you leave home but the fact of invasion." You see, he's wearing a big hoop skirt here. So to be a man wearing a dress isn't exactly a compliment. Here he's being called a coward, being compared to a lady doing women's work, essentially. So what does this mean for our men in dresses in the streets of Fredericksburg? Are they standing up and proclaiming, "That's right, I'm not a full man, I'm kind of a coward"? Not exactly. I think to these men, wearing a dress means something quite different, but we'll talk about that in a minute. All right, so again, to get back to our carnival sort of theme taking place in the streets, we have one of our greatest quotes. This is one of my favorites, again from the 20th Massachusetts, from George Bruce. "From a rebel stronghold, Fredericksburg had been converted into a center of loyalty. Clothed in the costumes of Virginia that were in fashion in the days of Mary Washington, a procession marched along a line with all the fun and frolic of Harlequin in his happiest mood. An old family coach, a relic of colonial days, was hitched to a mule with ears so long that they dropped on either side of his head by mere force of their weight, and driven the length of Caroline Street by a soldier in the mask of a Negro, with two representative belles of a bygone age sitting in the back seat and scattering smiles and kisses to an applauding crowd." So it isn't enough that they're dancing a cotillion. Now these men have actually hitched up an old carriage wearing old-style dresses that have been left behind, driven by someone who's most likely in some form of blackface in the front, parading down the main streets of town. These men are really having a ball. But what does it mean? Why are they having a ball? Why are they having cotillions? Why are they basically dressing themselves up as Southerners, as Southern women and Southern men? But it reveals, I think, both the depth of the anxiety that these men were feeling, their great desire to have fun, but then also a bit more to this looting. It isn't simply these men just having a ball, but in doing so, they're also mocking a lot of Southern conventions. By having someone in blackface driving them down the street, by having women in outdated clothes scattering kisses, they're mocking Southerners. They're not simply having a good time. They're making fun of their habits, and they're mocking women, Southern women. Why would they mock Southern women? Isn't it any gentleman's duty to not mock Southern women? Well, not when you've been participating in a war in which the women have largely been one of the greatest strongholds of Confederate sentiment. If you want to think about the women dishonoring Union soldiers in Louisiana and Benjamin Butler's response to that, basically saying that any lady who continued to dishonor Union soldiers would be considered a lady of the town, plying her vocation, or even Later on, if we're moving forward through time, if you think about the portrayals of Jefferson Davis when he's captured as being wearing petticoats, women's resistance, and this again also happened in Fredericksburg when Fredericksburg was occupied in the spring and summer of 1862, before the battle, women were dishonoring all of the Union soldiers here. So it seems that women are truly the heart of the Confederate sentiment. And so by mocking women, these Union soldiers are really striking a blow more towards the ideological side of things. And in doing so, again, they're striking at the heart of the Confederacy. But what did these men, again, think about what it is that they were doing? So moving on from what they were doing, a little more to what were they thinking about? What were they writing about? And so how did they justify their actions? We have a quote. Again, I've been quoting a lot from Massachusetts. Here's Captain John Adams, who said, "I left the men downstairs while I retired." He's staying in one of the homes that are unoccupied. He said, "The room I selected was the chamber belonging to a young lady. Her garments were in the press, and the little finery she possessed was scattered about the room. Fearing she might return, I did not undress, but went to bed with my boots on." So here we have some men who are trying to secure comforts while at the same time respecting some property rights and civility to some degree. But they find interesting things inside the homes, not just the food they're looking for and the women's clothing that some of them have donned. Here we have a quote, "Some members of Company D entered a fine house, found the table in the dining room just as the family had left it, the food untouched and the coffee cups full. Some of the chairs were tipped over, others were pushed back. The cause of the evidently hasty departure was plain. A cannonball had come in at one side of the room, passed directly over the table, and gone out through the opposite wall in the street." Again, emphasizes the rush that many citizens had in evacuating the town. I wouldn't have wanted to be at that dinner. But another quote, rich furniture became in the streets the lounging seat or couch of some tatterdemalions whom one would hardly dream were the heroes of yesterday and were to be among the heroes of the morrow. Rich carpets were cut up for blankets. Cooking stoves were carried into the streets for convenience in baking some soldiers' dinner. But, and here comes the key, to the eternal honor of soldiers, for the first time in possession of a conquered city, neither child nor woman was insulted or treated with aught but chivalrous respect. So we might think that the respect of personal property would trump anything else, would hold precedence here. But honor and respect to women and children are really the true keys if you're a Union soldier in Fredericksburg. That's the line not to cross here in the streets of Fredericksburg. Why? Why can we parade in their dresses, but we can't offer them true insult? Well, I think because at some base level, these men aren't vandal hordes. So surely they've been acting like that for some time in the streets. But they still pride themselves on having some line that they won't cross. Some of them disagree as to what that line is, because there are several officers and even several men who condemn the looting wholesale, who think that what is taking place is perfectly awful. But to some men, they're simply having fun at this town's expense, but heaven forbid they offer any woman any kind of offense. There's also a great story that I didn't want to put in because the quotation was just horribly long, and no one wants to be read a page worth of a quotation. But it basically gets to the heart of the matter of a soldier who has left the town following the battle and then realized that he had left some very important papers behind in the home that he was occupying. He rushed back to find that, you know, even though he had occupied this home, quartered his men in that home and in the streets outside, had taken whatever he needed, here were some women still in that home who were now being threatened by stragglers. And this man had nothing but basically one shot in his rifle and, as the quote put it, a stout heart. And he stood up for these women. And so, no matter what else he had done, he still feels fairly justified because he protected these women from these stragglers who were looking to offer them serious harm or perhaps just offense. And so by defending women, these men can feel better about what they're doing, maybe not feel better, but at least they know that they did have a line that they didn't cross, that there are some boundaries in the course of this looting. But again, I mentioned there are some people who think that all of this is wrong. There are several soldiers who simply say, this is wrong, in very plain terms. One of the most outspoken is Marcena Patrick, who is the provost marshal. So it's his job to have problems with this kind of behavior. He's tasked with keeping discipline in the army. What do you think his reaction is to the looting? All right, so here we have just an excerpt from the quote that I'm about to read to you, but I want you all, as I'm reading this to you, because this is awfully long and I apologize for that, think about what Marcena Patrick must have been experiencing, this, by the way, being Patrick himself. If you're tasked with keeping this army in line, and they've done fairly well to this point, they've certainly foraged and taken things that weren't theirs in the past, but it's mostly been more isolated incidents, and then you ride into the town of Fredericksburg. And this is what Patrick says. When I went into the town, a horrible sight presented itself. All the buildings more or less battered with shells, roofs and walls all full of holes, and the churches with their broken windows and shattered walls looking desolate enough. But this was not the worst. The soldiery were sacking the town. Every house and store was being gutted. Men with all sorts of utensils and furniture, all sorts of eatables and drinkables and wearables were carried off. And as I found one fellow loading up a horse with an enormous load of carpeting and bedding, I ordered him to unload it, which, failing to do so, I gave him a cut or two with my riding whip that started him in a hurry, and then put him with my prisoners. I found in the town a most deplorable state of things. Libraries, pictures, furniture, everything destroyed. And here's my favorite part. And the brutal soldiery still carrying on the work. He's referring to his own soldiers as the brutal soldiery who's still carrying on the work. So Patrick is so furious that he is gathering up prisoners. He is riding people down with his riding whip. He positions guards at each of the pontoon bridges. And eventually these huge piles of furniture. Remember Henry Abbott saying that his servant got stopped with a writing desk trying to go back across the river? So we get these huge piles of furniture stacking up at each of the river crossings so that nobody can take their loot back to the Falmouth side just in case the battle goes poorly. So you can imagine these huge piles of furniture, which, by the way, disappear overnight. So we're not really sure what happens to all the furniture. But the looting is so rampant, even up to the morning of December 13th, when the Battle of Fredericksburg is taking place, that Darius Couch of the 2nd Union Corps is calling for Patrick to clear the houses so that the troops would stop looting and fight. It's that bad. There's this much of a lack of discipline. But many of these men are holding very different opinions of the looting. You can tell not only Patrick, who is kind of the leader, of course, of these people who totally object to the looting, who think this is one of the worst things that any army could do. Certainly, Patrick is completely appalled at what's going on. But there are other people who have very different opinions. Remember Henry Abbott, again, who doesn't need these things but is taking them. Soldiers who are just looking for souvenirs of the town, some of them just looking for food, bedding, those sort of things. There's a great diversity of opinions. Everybody thinks something different about the looting of Fredericksburg. Hold on. Now I want to say a word about this picture, which I included here, partly because this is the Bank of Virginia. Some of you might have been able to discern as you were looking before at the sketch that there were words Bank of Virginia on the far left building. This is what's left of the Bank of Virginia afterwards. So it catches on fire, and actually, interestingly, Union soldiers attempt to put out the fire. So we get these old firefighters, I believe they were from Philadelphia, and some of the accounts are just great of how excited these men were to be putting out fires again when they had joined up the army. So not everything was destruction, although you could certainly ask the pertinent question of would the Bank of Virginia caught on fire if not for the Union Army. But in any case, scenes of desolation like this are going to be commonplace in Fredericksburg. If you consider the shelling of the town, which at some points was concentrated directly on shelling the town to try to get the Confederates dislodged from the riverbanks, and then the looting of the town, certainly Fredericksburg was going to suffer. But I also don't want you to get the opinion, or to become of the opinion, that this was all that was left of Fredericksburg, because there were many buildings that were still standing just fine, some that only had a few holes in them, and for the most part, the town itself was intact. But there are certainly examples of desolation, and I think it's worth considering the destruction that's taking place here. So if these men are having fun, what's the cost of their fun? And at the end of the day, what does it accomplish? And so one of the key things that I took away really from my college education about the Civil War was that the Civil War is a war of democracies. So we tend to think of it as a war of armies, or maybe a war of politicians, or a war of politicians in which armies got in the way. But at the end of the day, the Civil War is a war of democracies, which means that the opinions of the citizens matter, whether it's the citizens in the army, the citizens suffering from the army, the citizens on the home front, all of them. Their opinions matter, and they're going to be what determines the course of the war. And so actions like the looting have much larger ripple effects, much larger repercussions. But again, let's get back to what the soldiers were thinking for just a moment. Again, here we have several examples of soldiers looking to justify what they're about to do. Here we have Henry Ropes, another 20th Massachusetts Harvard boy, saying, "As the city was defended against us, of course it was given up to pillage." So some are saying, simply by the rights of war, because this city was fought for as a military holding, now that it belongs to us, it belongs to us. The Confederates, if the Confederates can use it for military purposes, we can use it for whatever purposes we want. So several soldiers are going to use this justification. I read it almost continuously while I was doing my research. But again, it's also important to note that part of this is because the Confederates had used it. Even Robert E. Lee, who had initially promised that he would not use the town for military purposes, would have recognized that as soon as he used it for military purposes, the whole game has changed. And he knew that when he put his men in the town of Fredericksburg, but he believed that the benefits outweighed the costs. And considering that the Confederates held off the Union Army for a day, delayed their movement so much that it was 2 days later, when they were finally able to assault the Heights, perhaps to Lee, at the end of the day, it really was worth it. I'm not saying that he was at all thrilled about what happened to the civilians of Fredericksburg and to their possessions, but in some ways, this is simply a military story in which a town got run over. But what about, again, what about the other soldiers? What did they think? And what's more, one of the questions that always stood out to me was, this is an American city. Don't they realize that? Don't they walk through the streets of town and say, this looks like home? Because honestly, Fredericksburg is a small town. It was a small town then. It probably looked like home to a lot of these soldiers, or the closest thing they had. And so I was continuously looking, doesn't anybody sympathize with this town beyond the women and children? Doesn't anyone sympathize with the town itself? And then I found someone who did. But the way that he understood it was so completely different from the way that I thought he would understand it. It's definitely worth reading. So this man's name is Josiah Fitch Murphy. He's, again, from the 20th Massachusetts. They're a very literate group, so they wrote a lot. He said, "Let us make a comparison. Nantucket," which is his home, "Nantucket occupies about the same area that Fredericksburg does, but the latter has more inhabitants. Now, suppose an army was about to bombard the town. The inhabitants would naturally leave in a hurry, taking but very little with them. And when the hostile troops gained the town, what a picnic would be in store for them. They would enter the houses and stores and help themselves. Well, that is just the state in which we found Fredericksburg when we entered the city, and of course the troops considered it common property and took whatever they wanted." So he does see it as just like home. And he's saying that should an enemy army approach Nantucket, he expects them to do exactly the same thing that he was just doing. Is that right? Is that how we would, looking back, think that he would think about it? Because it blew me away. I thought that anyone who sympathized with the plight of Fredericksburg as a town would have refrained from looting, would have condemned it. How could they do this? This looks just like home. I'm sure, however, that plenty of Confederates would be more than happy to have turned the tables on him after they saw what happened in Fredericksburg. But so in any case, some claim that it is their right, their military right. Some claim that it's the same thing that anyone else would do in their shoes. But the interesting commonality among almost all of these soldiers is that they're thinking about the looting and wondering whether it's right or wrong. To some, it's a perfectly decided question, but the fact that they're writing about it, trying to justify it, tells me that it isn't fully decided in their minds. Or perhaps a little bit differently, maybe they feel like they need to justify what they're doing to other people. that anyone in the army would understand what they were doing. But what about all of us? Do we understand if we simply looked at the desolation of Fredericksburg? Could we ever comprehend what these soldiers did as anything other than a horrible and tragic act? Probably not. Maybe that's why they're looking to justify. What about to their families? You can believe that most of these soldiers were not raised that they could steal, that they could enter homes and just take whatever they wanted, as long as the inhabitants weren't there. So they have to think about it. They have to write about it, and they have to try to explain to us why they did it. But here's another incident that I think lends a lot to our reflections. And these are described by, the next two quotes I'm going to read are described by two men in the same regiment, so they're probably very close by, and they give us a sense of both the absurd and the dire, which again reminds me of that mixture of death and frivolity that's really pervasive in the town itself. So we have, just about dark, one of the men of the regiment was seen to proceed rapidly up Caroline Street by devious lines toward the enemy's pickets, with a live goose by the leg in one hand and a black bottle by the neck in the other, in pursuit of a particularly lively pig, and singing, I dreamt I dwelt in marble halls, with the utmost power of a voice not especially melodious at any time, and not much improved by his recent potations. Very absurd. But then a contrast, another man from the 19th Massachusetts. One poor fellow was struck by a round shot, carrying away one side of his head and scattering his brains all around. Pigs were roaming around eating them. All happening probably within the same block. 19th Massachusetts was spread out in one kind of corner area. So here we have one man carrying a goose and a bottle in either hand, singing, and then another who can't take his eyes off of the human cost of gaining Fredericksburg. So what kind of emotions does this sort of scene elicit? Not only to us in looking back however many years it's been, 150 years later, but what if you were there? You're confronting scenes both ridiculous and very sobering, very somber. These men have learned to cope with such scenes, but how have they learned to cope? They need a release, don't they? And so to many people, the looting is simply that release. How can you deal with death? How can you deal with these kind of circumstances for so long? And what happens after you've dealt with them for so long? Which brings me really to my final quotation. I know I've bombarded you with a lot of them tonight, but I think this answers the underlying question that I think we've been thinking about all night. Why? Why would the average soldier, likely not a thief in normal circumstances, pillage a town, take items from families, non-occupied homes, while still knowing that, again, it looks a lot like home, that these inhabitants are going to come back to find the place an utter wreck? Well, Roland Bowen, of the 15th Massachusetts, who I've begun his quote here, offers us an answer. It's very deceptively simple, but at the same time, it's very complex. And Bowen, his account really drew me in when I read it, because Bowen is a fairly educated man, but not exactly the most well-written. So you'll notice as I read, his grammar is not the best. So this is really your average soldier. This isn't one of those blue bloods of Massachusetts, the 20th Mass. This is a simple private from the 15th Massachusetts. And he wrote, such is war, but we stole or destroyed everything in the city. Great was the ransacking thereof. Mother, you know but very little about war. One reb was killed with a cannonball, and 3 days after the hogs were eating up the body, and no one would take pains to drive them away. I was too busy stealing in the city. Besides, I knew the hogs wanted something to eat. Such is war. He repeats such is war twice. He emphasizes that his mother could not understand, as she is not in the midst of war. She doesn't see the horrors that Bowen himself is now very acclimated to, that he's so used to by now. But he's writing to his mother. To his mother, that he didn't stop hogs from eating another man's body. That there were remains in the street, and he did not drive the hogs away. To his mother. Can you imagine writing such a letter to your mother without being consumed by shame? But he writes, and he says, Mother, you know but very little about war. War has changed these men. I doubt that Roland Bowen 3 years ago would have ever written something like that to his mother, and I doubt that he would have ever dreamed that he would be in such a position to write it. So war is shaping how these men live their own lives, how they respond to situations. And in turn, they're changing war themselves. At the end of the day, these soldiers, through the guise of fun or entertainment or just reckless abandon, are striking a blow against the people that they find responsible. Going back to that war of democracies, war doesn't just play out on the battlefield. War plays out in the streets of everyday homes. Public opinion matters. That's why so many of these people mention that Fredericksburg is a secession town. Fredericksburg is full of Southern loyalists. They understand that this is a war of democracies. They understand that people have a say and that public opinion matters. And if they can strike a blow against the Southern home front, if they can strike a blow at those that public opinion, that might be some success. The Army of the Potomac isn't having much success lately. So despite the Battle of Antietam, you know that Fredericksburg is going to be a complete and utter disaster for them. How else are they going to gain a victory if their leaders can't lead them to it? Well, they can take matters into their own hands. And I'm not saying by any stretch that the looting of Fredericksburg was a concerted effort to strike against the home front, because it wasn't. There were so many factors that we've already looked at tonight that went into why these men did what they did. But I think that one of the underlying understandings that most of these people were considering as they went about was, this is a secesh town, and any damage that I can do to it is furthering our cause. That will justify, that will vindicate what I'm about to do. If secession had been popular among Southern citizens, would the Union Army be there? Would the Union Army be in Fredericksburg? Would it be in Virginia? Would these soldiers have to spend another night in the cold, far away from home and far away from their families? Maybe not. At the same time, do those families then deserve to lose everything for a cause that some of them may or may not support, simply because they left their homes in search of safety? Certainly not. And this cause actually becomes a rallying point throughout the Confederacy. In the aftermath of the looting, donations to the sufferers of Fredericksburg total nearly $20,000. Not only raised in the Army of Northern Virginia to support these families, but throughout the Confederacy. Donations roll in from everywhere, which is really quite a feat, $20,000. Might not seem like so much today, but of course at the time that was quite a sum. And so today, 150 years later, I think it's important for us to go through these accounts with an aim of understanding, not with saying what these men did was terrible, and also not with saying what these men did was great, because in some cases it was both, and in some cases it was neither. But I think it's more important that we understand why they did what they did. How do we understand these men, what was influencing them, and then how were they taking steps toward a larger cause? We're changing society and changing the way that war itself is prosecuted. It ultimately leads us to question the war's conduct, to understand the true nature of relations between Union and Confederacy at a balancing point. It's December of 1862. This is one of the midpoints of the war, definitely one of the moments where the war is balancing. It's a shifting point in not only the conduct of the war, the course of the war, but ultimately also in our understanding of the war. And so, thank you all for listening. If you have any questions, I know I've asked plenty of you, so by all means, send them right back. All right, yes, ma'am. All right, so the question was, how did the general command feel about this? Were they unaware, or did they just not care? The general command, if you're speaking about the high echelons of of the army, they were completely appalled. They were beside themselves, just like Marcena Patrick, again, whose job it was to keep discipline in the army. So the higher-ranking officers were very much against it. But it turns out that when you're actually on the ground, it's more the lower-ranking officers that determine what actually happens. And while some of them took very strict precautions, I guess, against this happening, kept their men very well ordered, there were a lot that looked the other way, and then there were several, like George Macy, by the way, when Henry Abbott, who is also an officer in the 20th Massachusetts, when Abbott is saying Macy found just the thing, Macy is the colonel of the regiment. So you've got the colonels, the lower grade officers, all of whom, well, not all of whom, but many of whom are participating, many of whom are turning a blind eye and simply not wanting to know what's happening, and then some, a few, who are condemning it and trying to control matters. So. Yes, sir.
Really set up Lee before Gettysburg and his orders. He had a general order, 72 or 74, that told the troops not to loot and to be respectful of private property and just take the corn and horses and so on that they needed.
Sure, and I think it's worth noting again, here it isn't so much a Union Army policy to take everything, but it is more of a lower level, mainly the average soldier's policy to take not only what he needs, but to take everything else. And so perhaps it also served as a warning to Lee as he headed north to say, wait a minute, if you don't control soldiers, they get out of hand. And I think it did impress itself on all of the Union officers, the higher-ups, who had been trying to control these sort of episodes, trying to keep them from happening, that whatever it was they were doing wasn't necessarily working once these men are set loose on a town. So, yes, ma'am.
So with all of this looting and destruction and obviously drinking and everything else, were any people harmed, any of the women or children harmed?
All right, so the question is, were any women and children actually harmed, or were any of the citizens actually harmed during the looting? Now, I would say, to my knowledge, none were necessarily harmed during the looting of the town. I know that there were some citizens who were injured or killed while the army is trying to gain the town, and some casualties, I believe, also from the battle itself. Of course, casualty being a relative term, there are some people who are simply so scarred from what they witnessed that I think you could consider them a casualty. But to my knowledge, nobody fell as a victim of the drinking, the carousing, the cotillions, the anything like that.
Because a lot of this seems to be an effort to humiliate the enemy. And
right.
And women would be another form of humiliation. That's what I just
Sure. Sure. So the addition there was that some of this seems to be with the intent of humiliating the enemy, and certainly to go after the women would be a form of doing so. But again, from what I've been able to tell, it seems like that's where the soldiers drew the line. They were not so undisciplined as to go about raping or even offering insult to women. And in fact, most homes, the best way to preserve your home and to save your possessions during the Battle of Fredericksburg was to stay in it. You didn't have to fear for your life nearly so much as you had to fear for your possessions if you were in the town itself. And so if you stayed, your house was likely to be untouched, except perhaps used as a hospital or something like that in the aftermath, or perhaps to offer quarters for some officer who wasn't about to take everything you had. But if the house was unoccupied, there was less of a deterrent, I think, among people. Yes, ma'am.
Saying is that they turned it on inanimate objects instead of because they couldn't get to the enemy.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think that's a great point. So what she's saying is that there's the frustration of sitting on the other opposite bank. I mean, and the Union Army arrives opposite Fredericksburg November 17th, 1862. The days of looting, even, that we're talking about in the beginning of the street fighting and so forth, December 11th through 13th. So it isn't quite a month that goes by of these men sitting across the river. And, yeah, the opportunity for a surprise and no battle for Fredericksburg at all had passed. They watched Lee not only arrive, but then also for Jackson to arrive, them all to gather their forces. They had several different attempts as Burnside tried to outmaneuver, all of which failed until Burnside finally decided to cross directly opposite the town. And then, you're right, the sharpshooters on one side. So these are very frustrated men. I think that's a very important point here, and one that that I'm sure many of the soldiers recognize themselves, as they find themselves not only powerless to get across the river and to do something for all of that time, but then once they do, it's such a struggle to get across, and then they still have to fight the battle. And so, yeah, I think frustration has a lot to do with it. So, yes, ma'am?
Do you know how much troops from Sussex and Virginia came and joined Lee?
The question was, how many troops from southwestern Virginia came to join Lee? I do not know at Fredericksburg. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But thanks. Yes.
You know, Cheryl asked, I thought, was a really good question. You and I talked about this on the telephone there's a great psychological study of the problem that police officers have after a high-speed chase. And it's very difficult for them when this person has been endangering everybody in the traffic. It's very difficult for the police when they get the culprit not to beat the heck out of them. Kind of frustration, like she was describing, with the Union Army. And then all of a sudden, they got the town, and they got all this pent-up frustration.
Yeah, that's a good point. They finally now also have a means in which to release some of that frustration. They've got a captive city on their hands. They can do whatever they want with it. A captive enemy city, so they don't even necessarily have to feel guilty, although I think the justifications prove that some of them do to some degree. But certainly, these are, and some of the men write about it, about how frustrated they are not so much that they're dwelling on their frustration, but simply saying that this is a way of ridding anxiety or a way of letting loose their frustrations. So they speak about it in more broader, vaguer sort of terms, but I think that that does get, to some degree, to the heart of the matter. So, yes?
Could you share with us the timing of coming over the pontoon bridges and getting up to Marine's Heights? Was the looting happening before, during, after?
All of the above. So the question is, can I share the timing of when the looting's taking place within the timeline of the battle itself? So the Union Army begins to try to lay its pontoon bridges about 1 o'clock in the morning, December 11th. They're about halfway across the river, maybe not quite halfway, when the sun rises, the fog lifts, and Confederate sharpshooters start to go at it. And it'll be fairly late in the day by the time Union soldiers have ferried themselves across the river, and it's about dusk by the time they've gained the second street in from the river. So they are still fighting for the town itself as the sun goes down. And so the troops are still actually all trying to get into the town. And so you notice a lot of the quotes I read were from some of the same people, some of the same units, a lot of Massachusetts guys, because for the most part, a lot of the looting takes place the evening of December 11th and the morning and during the day of December 12th, which means there's only so many units actually in Fredericksburg at that time. And so relying on a lot of those units to tell me what's happening that evening and that day as more troops are trying to come across the river. But the looting itself, and part of what, again, is so interesting about it, is that it lasts from that very evening, December 11th, all the way up to, including during the Battle of Fredericksburg, and a little bit after, even in the aftermath, you've got men looting. And, of course, looting of that nature happens on any battlefield, looting from the bodies and such. But I did mention, I think, Darius Couch, commander of the 2nd Corps, asking the provost marshal to clear the men out of the houses one by one, so that he'll have enough men to go forward and attack the Heights with on December 13th. So December 11th, 12th, and 13th, primarily the days of looting. So, yeah.
I'm wondering if you're in your reading, you're talking about how the war is about to change. Well, in just a few weeks, the war is about to change in a big way with the Emancipation Proclamation coming into effect. And here are these guys from Massachusetts, birthplace of abolitionism. Did you find any quotes that nature, like here we captured this ugly secesh town, we're going to make them pay.
All right, so the question is, what sort of quotes did I find basically on the eve of emancipation? Well, I was looking. I was very, very much hoping that somebody would make that connection for me. But the closest that I found was actually the fact that they had someone dressed in blackface or some kind of, they say, the mask of a Negro as they're parading down the streets. That is the only reference to, really, I mean, and some of them might write of encounters with slaves or with servants and so forth, but nobody actually writes anything direct relation to emancipation. I know that would just be golden, wouldn't it? But unfortunately, soldiers don't do what you want them to do. They do what they want to do. But they are writing, and so to kind of follow up to the end of your question, they are writing about what a nasty sea-sesh town this is and how it gets what it deserves. And some of them are very vindictive about that. Some of them are not at all, which is, again, showing us a great diversity of opinions. But unfortunately, yeah, no one writes immediately about the Emancipation Proclamation that's about to come into effect. So, yes, ma'am. Sure. So the comment is about basically expressing surprise that the soldiers didn't go after the people. But you also have to understand that to this point, soldiers have been fighting an extremely limited war. It's been growing a little more expansive as things go on. And so when we're looking at the Civil War, we tend to think of it as, firstly, a very limited war. It becomes a very much a hard war toward the end. Hard war is the term that we tend to apply to things, with Sherman's March being kind of the key example of that. But to this point, the most that these men have really done to actual citizens is go to a farm and take their chickens or take from their larder. So going after individual citizens, private citizens, is even something that I think would have been appalling to many of these men at the conclusion of the war, even as it had transformed almost entirely into something. Because one of the things a lot of people overlook or don't fully understand, even about Sherman's March, is that the goal wasn't necessarily to attack private citizens. It was to take their crops. It was to deny the South's ability to wage war, not so much to starve and kill all of its citizens, but to starve out its armies until it had to surrender. And so to them, there is still, I hate to stray into saying that there's this code of honor among men, because soldiers always prove that there are definite exceptions to that. But I think that is a line that they're not willing to cross. And we've already changed a little bit, because at the beginning of the war, there are definitely situations where you have people, the Union Army, set up to guard private property. And you do have that to some degree, even in Fredericksburg. There are a couple homes that are guarded by Union soldiers. And then there are some who quarter themselves in homes and protect the citizens that are there. So I know this is kind of a wondering sort of answer, but I think to these men, that would have been crossing such a line that it's unimaginable. Some of them were even appalled at what they were doing in the first place, let alone to think about, you know, going further to actually attack citizens. It wasn't seen very much, although it was a citizens' war in the sense of politics, it's not necessarily a citizens' war in terms of attacking citizens as though they are combatants. And, you know, even today when we fight very different kinds of war, and I would say harder sorts of war, in some ways, more gentle wars, depending. Even today, I think we see a great line between combatants and non-combatants. And when those lines blur, we become confused and have difficulties. But here in the streets of Fredericksburg, those lines are pretty clear. Women and children still left in their homes are not combatants. They aren't part of this, and there's no reason to make them combatants, even in cases such as this where it is war. I mean, it's war, but we're not making war on the town. We're making war on the army, and the town is in my way. The town is seen as a release, but not necessarily as something that they're fighting directly, I think. So, yes?
I think one of the things I thought about with this was the massacre of My Lai in Vietnam. And very much the soldiers reacting to they're being shot at, killed, so on and so forth, and the blurring of that line of, you know, they're not our people, we're not quite sure whether they're enemy soldiers or not, and the banners used to be, kill them all, let God sort them out, I think was one of the things that was part of that, but I think that's all part of the tension and the horror of war when you get that happening.
Right. I think anytime you have a confusion between what is a combatant and what is not a combatant, you're bound to have a real, and I hate to get even more university than anybody here, but you have a real cognitive dissonance in terms of how do I deal with this kind of situation. I have no idea. My two opposing ideals, they can't reconcile. And thankfully here, there is a bit of a line. We know who's a civilian and we know who isn't. But what about the property? Is the property a combatant? Is the property a non-combatant? Property is neither. If we destroy their property, we're not destroying their people. But we're certainly hurting them, aren't we? And one of the things that I found so very interesting about every time I read about the loss of property and the damages done to Fredericksburg is that it seems to have left such a deep, deep wound, not only in Fredericksburg, but throughout the South, and other loss of property instances bring up these same kind of feelings, that people are extraordinarily bitter about it. They aren't nearly so bitter about the fact that they lost their great-great-uncle in this war, that their great-great-uncle was killed, but that you stole their teacups. That is the greatest calamity. And so again, this kind of all plays into our discussion about combatants, non-combatants. It's okay for soldiers to die in war, but it is not okay for soldiers to come and take your things and destroy your homes. And so it's very interesting to me that Southerners, and I'm not saying that they don't feel the loss of life, because they certainly did, but what seems to have stuck with many of them through the years, even, you know, say this descendant whose ancestor did not steal that McGuffey reader, is you don't, you're more upset by the idea either that your ancestor was a thief or that your ancestor was robbed of possessions, more so than that you might have had an ancestor who was killed in a war. Just an interesting phenomenon.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.